History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative and ask a few questions, and then take the time to patiently listen as memories from long ago take on new life in the here and now. Life is always better for all of us when we listen to each other a little bit, isn't it? Our aim here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only do we find ourselves educated, not only do we become entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The men and women who served our country in World War II came from all over America and abroad. Immigrants from dozens of other countries earned their citizenship by serving. And among those born in this country, a diverse array of heritages represented, some facing greater obstacles than others as a result. On this program, we've met veterans who were Native American, Mexican American, Japanese American, talk about obstacles. After Pearl Harbor, they were classified enemy aliens. We've met vets who could trace their roots to Italy, Germany, Greece, Norway, you name it. But in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we're going to explore the memory of some of the more than 1 million African-American veterans of World War II. One of the favorite quotes I think I've ever heard on this program came from Navy Corpsman Robert Hammond, who took care of the Mumford Point Marines in the Pacific.
Sometimes I say, now, who do I really belong to? You know, I'm not going to say I belong to this group, I belong to that group. I belong to all of them. So that makes me 100% American with no hyphens.
No hyphens, he said, in keeping with what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would famously espouse, that idea that men and women should be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. Dr. King's right-hand man, Ralph Abernathy, had served in World War II, and Dr. King knew the collective service of African Americans in the war had created a groundswell of momentum in that quest for equal rights for all.
And see a man grappling with the problems of the bankruptcy of his nation, and come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. But I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., in his famous I've Been to the Mountaintop speech in Memphis in 1968, just before he was killed.
And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world.
As our nation remembers the legacy of Dr. King and the civil rights movement this week, here on Hometown Heroes, we're drawing your attention to a precursor to that, the service of approximately 1 million African-American men and women in World War II. We've heard about some of the life-threatening situations they faced overseas, but the inherent challenges of a still segregated military also presented opportunities for courageous stands that would fuel what happened in the decades that followed. One of those has come to be known as the Freeman Field Mutiny, described here by Mitch Higginbotham, a Tuskegee Airman who would fly with the 477th Bomb Group.
At that time, there had been a lot of unrest, racial unrest in the city of Detroit, and race riots had broken out all over Detroit and caused quite a crisis situation. The commanders at Selfridge Field was afraid that all was going to spill over into the military. They had segregated the officers' club there at Selfridge for white officers only, and blacks weren't permitted in the officers' club at Selfridge. Well, as a result of all this, the decision makers in Washington decided that we had to leave the Detroit area, and there was a service field available called Godman Field in Louisville, Kentucky. It's adjacent to Fort Knox, and it wasn't designed for that type of combat training at all. It was very insufficient, but that's where they relocated the 477 bomb group. And, of course, there wasn't a racial problem there because the little officers' club at Godman was, they were gladly relegated that to the black officers because the white personnel, officer personnel, could use the officers' club at Fort Knox, right, and it's approximately across the street. And so there was no problem there until when they found out how inadequate Godman Field, they decided to move the bomber group to Freeman Field near Seymour, Indiana, which is about 40, 50 miles from Indianapolis. And we'd heard about some difficulties there in the officers' club. We had decided then that we couldn't tolerate that situation. And when we arrived there at Freeman, there was a group of some of our fellows thought that they would test entry to the officers' club. And, of course, the commander found out that this was anticipated, and he had designated the provost marshal to be there to see that his segregated orders were carried out. We had decided in pairs of threes or fours, we would go over to test the officers' club. So that was where trouble began. And
Well, you saw trouble coming, didn't you?
Yes, indeed, we did, really. We knew that it was going to be a confrontation, but didn't know what the nature of it would finally end up as. Commander Robert Selway, Colonel Robert Selway, then...
Who was white.
Yes, indeed, he was. And he, acting in collusion with his commander, I guess he was three or four-star general, Hunter, was head of the entire 1st Air Force, which we were a part of. So Selway ordered the fellows that went into the club there to be arrested. They were placed in house arrest for overnight, and the next day he got the situation formalized then, whereby all of us would be given an opportunity, being interviewed one at a time and being ordered directly to sign papers that we read and understood the orders and would abide by them.
So you basically had to promise not to go into the all-white officers' club again.
Well, it was more than a promise. It was a matter of being individually ordered not to use by our immediate commanding officer, and read the articles of war regarding direct orders in time of warfare. And one section which was emphasized was that refusal to obey a direct order in time of warfare was punishable up to and including death. And, of course, death was emphasized.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the face of all that, 104 of us refused to sign. There was about, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 black officers and maybe less than 100 white officers, maybe 85 or so. When the 104 of us refused to sign, General Hunter sent down, we were placed under arrest immediately.
Well, and I want to get into your mindset, because obviously there's strength in numbers, and if 104 of you are doing it, it's maybe a little easier than doing it all by yourself. But
you hit on a good point there.
But where does that
head, so to speak?
Where does that courage come from, though?
Well,
what made you decide I'm not going to sign this?
This is where the difficult situation arose, because we had no idea how many would refuse. And if only a dozen or a half dozen of us refused in the face of the Articles of War, then we would have been out on a limb all alone, and I'm sure that limb would have been sawed off.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened that on principle we absolutely refused, and not knowing how many would be in our group. If it had been only a few, then, of course, they would have thrown the book at us. But being over 100 black officers in the black newspapers across the country, the Chicago Defender, Amsterdam News in New York, and the Pittsburgh Courier in Pittsburgh, which was the leading black newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, and that was read by white officers and then across some of our white officers as well. But they put pressure, and then we had contacted NAACP. Well, first we were flown back.
Well, and I want to get all that timeline, but I'm really interested in your personal decision to do this, knowing that they could throw the book at you, that anything could happen up to execution. But you had the courage to stand up and say, this is wrong, I'm not signing this. Where did that come from? How did you arrive at that decision?
Well, I was always incensed by this kind of action. And I would determine, you know, it was a matter of principles that I just couldn't stomach to be a part of something that where, in first place, ordering you to sign your name, I felt was illegal. I didn't know, you know, but I just, from what the education and whatnot that I had, I knew it wasn't right. And I was determined to go by principles. And face the music, so to speak.
No matter what it meant, nothing scared you off.
Well, it didn't. And you look back, we were 20-year-old guys, 21, 20, 19, some of us, and just were determined that we wouldn't succumb to that sort of arrangement.
So they arrested you.
They arrested, and General Hunter sent down 3 C-47s. And they marched us down to the flight lines, and the enlisted men were observing and taking pictures of what was going on with their cameras. And most of the cameras were confiscated, but some of them got through, and they had pictures on the front page of the black newspapers likening the situation to Hitler's actions in Germany.
Mm.
And so I have some copies of the Pittsburgh Courier citing these pictures and citing in the headlines the Gestapo type of operations that was occurring at Freeman Field, Indiana.
Well, that's a pretty powerful comparison, given everything that people had heard about what was happening in Europe.
Indeed. And in our lockup, we contacted them. NAACP and Thurgood Marshall was head of the legal department. The NAACP had agreed to represent us in a court-martial trial. So it was so much pressure. We had some influential black people, the professionals, the parents of many of us, and they applied pressure. The pressures exerted were sufficient to get a change, and they sent down a group of colonels from Washington to investigate the situation, and they investigated in Freeman, and they came down to Godman. We had a fellow named Coleman Young, who later became mayor of Detroit for 4 terms.
Yeah.
He was one of us, and he was maybe a year or two older than me, for instance. He had some training as a labor leader in the auto workers union there in Detroit. So he had some kind of knowledge, and those kind of pressures eventually ended up in 101 of us being released with letters of reprimand placed in our files, reprimanding us for that type of disobedience. That remained on our records till 1995.
So for 50 years, even though you'd been released, you still had this.
Still had the reprimand on our records of the 101. But the 3 that were court-martialed, Bill Terry, Marsden Thompson, and Shirley Clinton. 2 of the fellows were found not guilty, I guess you'd call it, and 1 fellow was convicted in the court-martial.
And that was your roommate?
That was my roommate, Bill Terry. Bill Terry was convicted and fined $150.
But in 1995, he received a full pardon and got his $150 back. The so-called Freeman Field Mutiny, a significant moment on the path towards the integration of our armed forces. And eventually, the other developments that we celebrate this week in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. You can link to the original full-length interviews with the veterans you're hearing from today at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this.